I'm in Bellingham, Washington, professional engineering, Washington State. And I've worked in the energy industry for a really long time. I was started my career in the energy industry and became an environmental engineer in practice more than in learning, because I'm a chemical engineer from the University of Illinois. But I've always, you know, felt my call from the moment I was probably 15 years old that I needed to do something about the environment. So I think that this place, Holden Village, allows you to go more deeply into what your call is. And I really, truly appreciate it. I haven't been here for a long time, but our community and our church has a long-standing relationship with Holden Church. So a friend of mine said, hey, there's a reforming your relationship with creation as one of the subjects for Holden Summer, the Fear Not program. In education, I said, oh, well, that sounds pretty darn wonderful. I'm pretty excited about getting people to reform their relationship with creation and God. So so I wrote out a short synopsis for each one of my classes, and I said, you know, this is kind of controversial, but I think that, I think that people will really like this, so or be open to learning about it. So that's kind of how I came up with my three topics. And they really kind of are a progression in that we're talking about major issues today, but we're also going to talk about ways to reform our relationship with creation. So, let's see. I think we'll just start out, okay? And if you have questions, just pop up a hand. And I'm sorry, I'm an engineer. I do speak in acronyms. So if you don't understand something, go stop. What the heck is that? You know? Excuse me, pardon me. But yeah, my husband's really good at going, what on earth are you talking about? So he's my client in the back of the room.
Is he the one that's not eating your chocolate? And
no.
He's somewhere else.
Okay. So, let us make humankind and let them have dominion over the fish of the sea, over birds of the air, over the cattle, over all the wild animals of the earth. So Genesis 1:26. But that question of dominion, mm-hmm. Oh my gosh, that question of dominion, it's so important. And it's been so confused. And, you know, it's happened to man since Genesis. What is dominion? What does dominion mean to you? So we're going to talk about that a lot. Okay. And as you know, one of the learned people that I went through a whole bunch of articles about dominion and what it means to us today. And it does not mean destruction, but it means responsibility. Okay. So climate change refers to significant changes in global temperature, precipitation, wind patterns, and other measures of climate that occur over several decades or longer. So that's from UC Davis's definition of climate change. And I thought that was extremely appropriate. And I didn't expect Peter to be here, so.
Did you pull that off of, what website did that come from? I'm curious.
It was from UC Davis's
okay.
Climate change section, yeah.
Because, I mean, we obviously have people, I'm land, air, and water resources, mm-hmm. and we have an atmospheric department in there,
yes.
and we obviously focus
yeah,
on that.
Yeah, it
was
from the atmospheric department, yes.
Okay, so it is close to home.
It is. So, climate change has happened throughout recorded history, and evidential proof prior to 1650. Mm-hmm. So there are lots of ways and mechanisms where they've determined, you know, the concentration of CO2 in the atmosphere. I don't know. There was an absolutely fantastic PBS program on climate change. And what I loved about it most was that the lead narrator for it was a meteorologist out of Minnesota who said he was one of the biggest climate change deniers. And he totally flipped around on the subject. So it was really fun to listen to what he had to say and why on earth was he so skeptical. And I mean, I'll show you why he was skeptical. But it's really important that that we understand that there are mechanisms that people have used for sampling ice cores and determining whether or not what the level of CO2 was in what year, and developed all these graphs. But, you know, we are human, and there's a lot of doubt also as to the accuracy of the data. But we do have very, very accurate data from 1650 on, okay? So, the Christian answer to climate change is widely diverse. So we've got, on one side, climate change skeptics, and on the other side, we have climate activists, right? So we're doing, you know, we're this polarity. And climate change skeptics say, the overall temperature increase is small. I mean, since 1950, it's really only been 1 degree centigrade. Okay? And climate models show that variations in climate occur due to just a quarter of a degree centigrade. Other sources of greenhouse gases are much larger than human impacts, like, let's take, for instance, volcano eruptions. Well, I'm going to show you that data later on, but human contributions have increased carbon dioxide from 500 million tons to 8,500 million tons in the last 100 years. So God has control of the weather, and my impact is tiny. So why should I have to do anything or make any changes? Because God is really in control. So humans need to reduce their impact now to prevent more catastrophic change. And I think that that, to me, is really, really clear when I look at permafrost. And I'm going to talk about that. Because that's something that we in North America really, really feel the impact from, is those changes. Anyway. The government can't control the weather and should not stop progress. And we'll see that the gross production globally has continued to increase. And we have tried somewhat to put the rain back on CO2 concentrations. And I'll show you a map that shows that connection as well. But basically, it's gone up at a much steeper pace than our CO2 emissions, mm-hmm. because we have become aware and we are trying to do something. But we need global initiatives and government commitments. You know, and we all know about the fact that, you know, we've signed international treaties, and then now the United States has gone back on international treaties. Go ahead.
Yeah, I just want to comment on the progress. Progress basically means extracting the resources of the planet. Even if you don't look at CO2, we are exhausting this planet. Mm-hmm. So our attitude toward it is to take it all, use it up, and throw it in a big dump heap when we're done. So I really react to that word progress.
Yes.
Because it isn't progress to destroy creation.
It isn't. Not at all. And I think with what that specific mention was, again, progress is in production, as in
right.
the adaptations and the changes that we can make as the human race. Mm-hmm. So, but thank you. So, sea ice decrease. Sea ice usually expands Alaska to Russia, all the way down to Lower Canada, across, you know, along Scandinavia and everywhere. So it's sea ice normally, it's normally a solid block of white in that whole blue space. The reason what NASA has done, wonderful NASA, they have taken pictures from above of what sea ice looks like. And this is the time of year this picture is taken so that we can look at the worst case scenario. So during the summertime, when we're at our highest or, you know, most prolonged temperature, so probably in August or early September every year, they record what the sea ice looks like. And they can also, with thermal imaging, determine the thickness of that ice as well. So you can see the orange outline. That's kind of been the average sea ice over the years that they've been recording it, which I can't remember the exact year that they started. But, you know, sometime in the 70s or they started recording it. You can see that the orange in the 70s, that's where we were, and it was more solid white. It was pretty densely white. But in 2012, the lowest density and the lowest, smallest extent that we've seen of sea ice. And that scared people. Oh, that really scared people. Go ahead.
So I'm trying to understand the graph. So the bright white is more current, and then the light blue is recent history?
No. The bright white is dense ice, thick ice. The blue, the light blues, are thin ice. It's much thinner ice sheet than there's ever been. So the ice sheet normally goes from the corners, you know, along the black lines. And then in the worst, you know, the average over like 30, 40 years has been the orange line.
For the dense ice?
For the extent. The orange line has been the extent in summer, at the end of summer. And then, but it's also been really white in that orange area. So for us in 2012, this was an extremely scary picture because not only is it so much smaller, but it's so much thinner. So they were pretty shocked.
Well, one thing that that graphic doesn't capture is that as the ice melts, it creates rivers, and there are huge rivers through ice that are causing the melt to go even faster, and that's what's making big chunks break off.
Exactly, and that's the case like in Greenland, where it's onshore and also offshore, where it's actually, you know, like if you look at an iceberg, you know, it ice sheets, the way they move, the way it was predicted in the 1990s, they predicted, oh, well, we'll see so much sea level rise, and we'll see so much because of the glacier melts and stuff like that. But what they didn't predict was how the ice was going to melt. They had it kind of like
Just an L.
In a straight line. This is how it's melting.
Yeah.
But that's not how the ice is melting. If you look at like Exit Glacier up in Alaska, what's happened is it's melted underneath and it chunks, it calves off in much bigger chunks than it ever has.
Yeah.
And that's, like you said, the prediction, the original, you know, straight line thought was that, oh, you know, we're okay for, you know, a couple hundred years. Well, no, that's not the case because of the way things are affecting. The permafrost is the same, and I'll show you a picture of that. Okay, so permafrost loss is at record rates, and the reason why it's at record rates is snowfall isn't, we're not getting as thick a snowfall, and the snowfall is what protects the permafrost. So without the snowfall and form like little cells, so what's happening is it's melting all around the cell of permafrost and underneath. So we are getting big, like we're losing big expanses of it in these chunky cells, because when they go and their neighbors go, and you know, because it's this circumference around these cells of permafrost. So I used to work for the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers Research Laboratory in Champaign, Illinois, and was associated with the Cold Regions Research Laboratory. And we've been working on permafrost loss since, you know, 83, 84, we've been studying permafrost loss. I've also worked for companies up in Alaska and worked for engineering company, and we did projects up on the North Slope. And what they do is they want to make sure that their structures all stand, right? So they, when they engineered and designed them, they had a certain layer of thickness for their foundations in permafrost. But when you put a concrete building, or you put anything over, you know, ice, and then you put mechanical equipment in it, mechanical equipment generates a lot of heat. So they had to put in these things called thermosiphons. And so it's this big siphon tube that basically transfers cold back into the ground to make sure that that ice, that permafrost, is going to remain. Because without it, you know, we have equipment that's generating heat, and heat does not just go up, it goes up and down and everywhere. So it's caused more heat rejection into the atmosphere up there, unfortunately. More heat transfer into the atmosphere, which has also caused thinning of the snow layer. So they're trying to find this way to keep these structures viable up north of the Arctic Circle. And they're having great difficulty. And that's one of the reasons why so many people want to study it, is they're more concerned about their structures and their buildings and everything. But it's a really big deal. And when we lose permafrost, what they didn't take into account is that we release a whole bunch of methane into the atmosphere, which is 25 times more potent than carbon dioxide as a greenhouse gas. So now we're releasing more methane in that they didn't predict either. So again, they had this straight line prediction that was totally wrong. And we didn't know that that was how the natural systems worked. My husband and I were watching this a Netflix wonderful one, The Wonders of the World or something like that. And they had pilot flying over Siberia, and he normally flies the supply route over Siberia, and he noticed that there were these gigantic holes, and there were like so many of these gigantic craters, and they weren't there the last time he flew over, and he was amazed. And so he contacted someone in the government, and they came out, and scientists from all over the world came and studied these things, and it was basically because permafrost had melted, released methane in this big explosion of methane gas going into the atmosphere. Mm-hmm. So they've seen evidence of it, we're seeing evidence of it. It's very apparent that things are happening at a much faster rate than anyone predicted. This is sea level rise, and pardon me, I couldn't snip it correctly, but it's not that much. That's kind of what other people have said, is that it's really not that much. Remember what the date was, but can you read the date? It's like 1880 to present. But we've had sea level rise before. We know because we find fossils that are way far inland than we've ever seen. So we're finding shell fossils way up in the mountains and things like that. So we know that it's happened before. Has it happened while we've been alive? While the human race has been here? I don't know. It says sea level rises have been about 8 inches since the beginning of the 20th century. They believe that we're going to increase about, it says 3 feet there, but I've heard later predictions that say 3 meters. And I know that that's the risk analyses that I've been doing for various developments, is we're trying to take into account 3 meters by the end of the 21st century.
The problem is that this is just an average, and it doesn't work this way all over the globe. So like on the west, the eastern boundaries of the ocean, so the west coast of the U.S., there's very little sea level rise right now. But if you go into the western boundary, Philippines, they're getting massive sea level rise, and it works the same way in the Atlantic Ocean too. And so, for us, it doesn't look like it's a problem, but you go to the East Coast and Florida and those places, it is a problem because of that difference in the way that it works from one side of the ocean to the other side of the ocean, and that has to do with ocean circulation patterns and things like that. So that's a fundamental problem with, that folks see this sea level rise here and they think, well, it's not a big deal, it's so small. But in certain places, it's a huge deal. Islands are disappearing. Mm-hmm.
That's it, exactly. Islands are disappearing. And it's going to be more impactful around the equator.
New Orleans, up in the Gulf of Mexico, I'm not so sure about that. I think the biggest problem there is just the fact that they've diverted all the sediment. They don't let the sediment go out into the floodplains and keep everything built up. It just gets ejected straight out into the Gulf, and so then you get settling and sinking of the wetlands out there. So I'm not sure I think that's probably the bigger problem with sea level rise in the Gulf, is just the fact that that all that sediment is just going straight out into the Gulf instead of allowing it to flood naturally and keep the delta built up and all the wetlands built up.
And I think I looked specifically at New Orleans, and theirs was going to be about a 4 foot rise. Mm. But a 4 foot rise in New Orleans is an impact.
Well, and to complicate our building patterns, we're based on old data, and so many things are built right up to the shoreline. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's like when I lived in Arizona and we'd have these 1,000-year floods. Well, yes, if you build your house in a floodplain, riverbed, mm-hmm. you're going to have 1,000-year floods. Mm-hmm. And so not only the sea level rise, but the fact that we built so close. In Miami, they're going to spend billions on seawalls down there because they're right up to the ocean line.
In 2017, where we live in the Pacific Northwest, we had 4 100-year storm events. So that's extremely rare. I've lived in the Pacific Northwest for 30 years. We had 1 year where we had, I think, 2 100-year flood events, storm events. So down in California, they're actually changing their design criteria right now because they're trying to get the storm events up to whatever the new 100-year storm event record is. So for design. So yes, it's sea level rise is going to affect people more between, you know, near to the equator, and that's kind of what we're seeing right now.
And it's the same issue with temperature. Everybody thinks here's global warming and thinks, well, then everything is going to rise about the same amount, but it's just so variable. I mean, the Arctic is rising twice as fast as everywhere else around the globe. And
I've got a video that shows that.
Yeah, it's just...
It is. It's pretty amazing.
But it's all the kinds of stuff that really feeds into the climate skeptics thing there. Mm-hmm. And so it's just...
Well, this is what feeds into climate skeptics a lot, is the carbon dioxide concentrations that we're talking about. And that's because, you know, we go through these cyclical periods of, you know, we'll have a really, really steep increase in carbon dioxide concentrations. And so people go, oh, well, yeah, that's fine. We're just in one of those really steep ones. Well, we don't look like anything that's ever happened before. The oceans absorb 93% of the heat retained by greenhouse gases. And this has led to changing ocean currents, increased ocean acidification, and sea level rise. And believe me, changing those ocean currents, what do you think that impacts the most?
Storms.
Yep. Yeah. Your storm developments and how intense those storms are.
Mm-hmm. And that acidification, you know, we can't grow mussels and mm-hmm. things that have been shellfish
right.
production in Puget Sound any longer.
Yeah.
Well, the poor little guys just can't build up
calcium
and they can't
right.
build up calcium.
Because it's just being sucked out of them. Right. Mm-hmm. Right. And then, wait, let me get rid of the other one. Oh, just that with the loss of our glaciers, another thing that's hit Puget Sound is that we've lost a lot of our underground rivers that feed cold water directly into the sound.
Mm-hmm.
And so our herring population has gone bye-bye. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
So where did we lose them?
Because they only can spawn in certain temperature water.
Underground rivers.
Oh, because the glaciers are going away due to the global warming.
So they melted away from the mouth of the river?
So they lost their source of cold water.
All right.
Yeah.
The mass of the ice has decreased.
The mass of the ice has decreased in the glaciers, and so mm-hmm. we've lost the flow and amount of underground water that we had going into Puget Sound. Mm-hmm. And then this is the scary one. Oh, no. Yeah. What happened to me? I jumped. There we are. Okay. Mm-hmm. So we're going to see if I can figure out. Steve, I'm going to try and flip things around here. So I'm going to see how well this works for me.
Well, you saw what I went through.
I know. I'm kind of scared.
You have my sympathy.
I'm kind of scared here. Okay, so this is global temperatures from 1880 to 2017. The if it's like bluish to white, that's colder than normal. That's minus, I think it's only like minus 2 degrees centigrade with the deep blue. And then if it's yellow, orange, red, that's in the global warming. warmer temperatures plus 2 degrees centigrade, I think. So we'll see, kind of see how things have changed over time. And the period of time is up in the upper, and these are annual average temperatures. This is not...
This is reference to 1880, so 1880 would be a white map.
You want to see it again?
Yes.
Yes.
Okay.
Yeah,
play it again.
Okay. You're not a lot of fun, do you know that?
I knew I was going to make people sad today. Okay, I've got to get my...
Well, that is a good point, because one of the things I'm reading is that we Christians need to have services and ceremonies and ways to deal with the amount of despair and grief that we are going through. Mm-hmm. You can't just take this at an information level. It just, you know, it just soaks right into you, and it's very, very painful.
Yes.
And we have to figure out how to do that in our congregations, so that we can move forward and not be just immobilized in despair and hopelessness and maybe just saying, well, I just turn it over to God and I'm going about my own little daily life and I just can't pay attention to the rest of it. You know, we have to equip people to be able to move forward.
We do. We do. And we have to equip ourselves with, you know, a lot of where our faith is, where our call is, and then educate our communities. And then our communities will reach out and educate others. And I, you know, yes, it's a grassroots advocacy, but there are also advocacies that are more developed, and I will talk about those later this week. Sorry. So have you considered how wide the earth is? Tell me if you know all this. And I think about Job, and I think about Job standing there, and I think sometimes that's how I feel, that overwhelmed feeling, that the despair that Job has. And so I just really think it's important. What do we know versus what God knows and does? Job is humble. Are we really humbled about this? And no, I don't think we are. Mm-hmm. I think we're pretty dang arrogant. So I wrote these creation references from Psalms in the New Testament, and I really would love it if people would care to read some of them aloud. So the first one I had was Psalm 24, 1 through 6.
I can read that.
Sure.
A Psalm of David. The earth is the Lord's and the fullness thereof, the world and those who dwell therein. For he has founded it upon the seas and established it upon the rivers. Who shall ascend the hill of the Lord? And who shall stand in his holy place? He who has clean hands and a pure heart, who does not lift up his soul to what is false, and does not swear deceitfully. He will receive blessing from the Lord and vindication from the God of his salvation. Such is the generation of those who seek him, who seek the face of the God of Jacob.
So that gives me hope. Okay, anyone? Psalm 46.
God is our refuge and strength, a very present help in trouble. Therefore, we will not fear, though the earth should change, though the mountains shake in the heart of the sea, though its waters roar and foam, though the mountains tremble with its tumult. There is a river whose streams make glad the city of God, the holy habitation of the Most High. God is in the midst of the city, it shall not be moved. God will help it when the morning dawns. The nations are in an uproar, the kingdoms totter. He uttered his voice, the earth melts.
The Mighty One, God the Lord, speaks and summons the earth from the rising of the sun to its setting. Out of Zion, the perfection of beauty, God shines forth. Our God comes and does not keep silence. Before him is a devouring fire and a mighty tempest all around him. He calls to the heavens above and to the earth,
that he may judge his people. Gather to me, my faithful ones, who made a covenant with me by sacrifice. The heavens declare his righteousness, for God himself is judge. Hear, O my people, and I will speak. O
15, 1 through 15.
No, sir. O Israel, I will testify against you. I am God, your God. Not for your sacrifices do I rebuke you. Your burnt offerings are continually before me. I will not accept a bull from your house or goats from your folds. For every wild animal of the forest is mine. The cattle on a thousand hills. I know all the birds of the air, and all that moves in the field is mine. If I were hungry, I would not tell you, for the world and all that is in it is mine. Do I eat the flesh of bulls or drink the blood of goats? Offer to God a sacrifice of thanksgiving and pay your vows to the Most High. Call on me in the day of trouble. I will deliver you, and you shall glorify me.
Then he said to his disciples, therefore I say to you, do not worry about your life, what you will eat, nor about the body, what you will put on. Life is more than food, and the body is more than clothing. Consider the ravens, for they neither sow nor reap, which have neither storehouse nor barn, and God feeds them. Of how much more value are you than the birds? And which of you by worrying can add one cubit to his stature? If you then are not able to do the least, why are you anxious for the rest? Consider the lilies, how they grow. They neither toil nor spin. And yet I say to you, even Solomon in all his glory was not arrayed like one of these. If then God so clothes the grass, which today is in the field and tomorrow is thrown into the oven, how much more will he clothe you, O you of little faith? And do not seek what you should eat or what you should drink, nor have an anxious mind. For all these things the nations of the world seek after, and your Father knows that you need these things. But seek the kingdom of God, and all these things shall be added to you. Do not fear, little flock, for it is your Father's good pleasure to give you the kingdom. Sell what you have and give alms. Provide yourselves money bags which do not grow old, a treasure in the heavens that does not fail, where no thief approaches nor moth destroys. For where your treasure is, there your heart will be also.
So we know we're called. Mm-hmm. We're called to do something. But it's God's will, and we are God's hands and feet in this world, and so it's our responsibility. Anybody have Romans 18 for me? Or 8, sorry, 8. There's no Romans 18. Romans 8. Go ahead.
I consider that the sufferings of this present time are not worth comparing with the glory about to be revealed to us. For the creation waits with eager longing for the revealing of the children of God. For the creation was subjected to futility, not of its own will, but by the will of the one who subjected it, in hope that creation itself will be set free from its bondage to decay and will obtain the freedom of the glory of the children of God. We know that whole creation has been groaning in labor pains until now, and not only the creation, but we ourselves, we have the first fruits of the Spirit grown inwardly while we wait for adoption, redemption of our bodies. For in hope we are saved. Now hope that is seen is not hope. For who hopes for what is seen? But if we hope for what we do not see, we wait for it with patience. Likewise, the Spirit helps us in our weakness, but we do not know how to pray as we ought. But that very Spirit intercedes with sighs too deep for words. And God, who searches the heart, knows what is the mind of the Spirit, because the Spirit intercedes for the saints according to the will of God. We know that all things work together for good for those who love God, who are called according to his purpose.
Those are wonderful promises. So I try not to get overwhelmed because I need to remember those promises. And I also have experienced so much grace in my life and I know how powerful our God is. I mean, I just know how powerful God is. Had so many things happen in my life that I can just say, yes, yes. I believe in his promises. And I believe that we need to take our responsibilities seriously as God's people. So this is just kind of my, here are the facts type of information. When people say that the natural impact is so much more than man-made, it's just not true. You know, the total 6,200 million tons per year from volcanoes, forest and shrubland fires, animal exhalation. It's 6.2 gigatons a year. Man-made, our transportation, electricity, industry, commercial, residential, and agricultural uses are 32.5 gigatons a year of emissions. And then land use is another 4.1, and our total is 36.5 gigatons, or 36,500 million tons per year. Go ahead.
A worry that I've had for a while is that, have we gone too far? Can we save the planet even? But it's, you know, to see everything so stacked against it right now is really hard.
It's hard,
hard
to see
to keep hope.
Mm-hmm. I think a key part of that is what do you mean by save the planet? Because that's
our
everybody's
planet.
Got a different definition of what that actually means.
I think it's
so,
the heat for me. Saving the heat.
But saving the planet could mean eliminating human species. That would be a radical interpretation of saving the planet, so I'm just curious to know how
so
you
then
define that.
Yeah, where do we go? You know, no. Kind of thing. But where's our escape valve kind of thing? I mean, when you look at this, and I never thought I'd see this in my lifetime.
Mm-hmm. Well, Matthew Fox says that we may be the first species to cause our own extinction.
Yes. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And he's a theologian. Mm-hmm. I mean, I think people really need to think about it in terms that start so that they can really think about their lifestyle and the choices and the kind of leaders we have and the whole progress that we have set in motion, mm-hmm. and we kind of act like it's this ship that there's no way to turn it aside. Well, you know, mm-hmm. This ship has a motion to it because of all of us. So,
go ahead, Peter.
Oh, I was just going to say that, you know, in terms of sustainability and thinking about how many people can, like, what is the carrying capacity of the planet? I mean, that's a popular way of trying to think about sustainability. You know, we're at pushing 7.5 billion right now, but in terms of deep ecology, thinking about humans coexisting with all the other species and not just being so anthropocentric, in deep ecology, the carrying capacity of the planet, some people think it's like 200 to 300 million, and we're at 7.5 billion. So it just kind of depends on how stark or how far back you want to roll things. But I think to some extent, you're right, we kind of have gone past and we have to roll back. But it's a question of, you know, of values and many, many other things to kind of make some sort of a guess as to what a proper rollback number might be in terms of population, for example. But it's not just population, it's also consumption. So it's consumption plus population mixed together.
So in the 1980s, NASA, wonderful NASA. Anyway, they discovered that there was thinning of the ozone layer at the poles, and especially at the North Pole. So a lot of scientific work went into what is causing the thinning of the ozone layer. We found out that it was carbon fluorinated compounds, compounds that were causing the issue. The fluorides would go up and react and suck the, you know, the extra oxygen out of the ozone, and it's because fluoride's more, you know, electron-loving than oxygen is even electron-loving. So the chemistry of it all made sense. We knew, we've been doing this. We've been using a lot more refrigerants. We've been doing a lot more aerosol sprays. You know, I just thought your hair spraying all up. Anyway, we were spraying everything back then. And those fluorides were a propellant for sprays. So internationally, an international panel was put together to study it and to come up with what they thought targets should be for reduction of consumption of this chemical, or elimination of a lot of these chemicals. So we did that, and it took not very long for that legislation to come into place all over the world. And those fluorinated carbons have been booted out. We still use some more stabilized fluorinated carbons for our refrigerants. Even those we should probably be getting rid of. So there's still some progress being made in reducing those. Why do we think North America is having such more difficulty than the Northern Hemisphere? Northern Hemisphere having such more difficulty with global warming than the Southern Hemisphere? It could be because we had more of an ozone loss up there than they lost in the Southern Hemisphere. So we know that we can make movement happen. We know we can make change happen. And we also know that people and their buying power highly influences what's produced on a global, spectrum. So it is. We've got to make those choices. We've got those decisions to make. We've got a lot of them to make. Go ahead, Steve.
Well, here's a minor rant, and you heard part of it at lunch. I went to the first Earth Day, 1970, Kansas City. We had teach-ins. This has just been yakety, yakety, yakety for 50 years. Mm-hmm. And at some point, as I was mentioning at lunch, which is not enough, I understand this, we have to take personal responsibility. Mm-hmm. And that's where I think we need the support. I mean, Europe, for example, has, I think, made some positive strides, not enough, but they have a whole different sense of ecology in Europe than we have here. Mm-hmm. And, you know, what's it going to take? I mean, these next two elections are going to be absolutely critical in terms of things like this. And yet the complacency of people not being politically involved, not voting, not making their voice known, when are we going to get past that? And I mean, I've written more letters to congresspeople this last 2 years than I have in my entire life. And I'm not going to quit. And so I think we're not going to get a change in the government unless we do something. Mm-hmm. And quit buying products that are destructive. Mm-hmm. And at some point, good heavens, we've been talking 50 years.
Yeah. Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. I totally agree with you.
But what I would add to that is, I want Christian churches to be a beacon of hope in the community. I want my congregation to be saying to young people, we want a world that you can inherit. We want a world, because right now we are offering our children and grandchildren such a world of chaos, and no generation has ever done that. We always want to do better for those coming up. And they're the innocents. They didn't get to choose all this awfulness, and we're handing it off. And I just don't see enough of that kindling. I don't see
Well, it's part of the complacency.
Exactly.
I mean, our congregation finally quit using styrofoam. Hello, it's not that big a deal to wash dishes, okay? I mean, that's the concrete kind of stuff.
Mm-hmm.
We can just in all we want to, but wash your dumb dishes and don't use styrofoam.
Mm-hmm.
Get rid of plastic straws and buy the permanent ones from Amazon. I mean, it's there if we take responsibility.
Mm-hmm.
I'm done.
Go ahead.
Well, I think, you know, for the comment of talking about these environmental issues, I think unfortunately in the last 20 to 30 years, we haven't really heard much in society. I mean, yes, if you tune into it, you are, but sort of on the most broad sense of, you know, it's not in everybody's communication, it's not in everybody's foreground. We stopped talking about it. And in the 70s and 80s, yes, we were, but, you know, we just sort of got sidetracked in all sorts of other issues.
Mm-hmm.
That we haven't, you know, we haven't really heard enough of anything that happened. I don't think I've ever really been to.
Well, you have to add to that the fact that the fossil fuel industries have made a concerted effort to suppress. They have taken the same playing hands that the tobacco industry has done. So they've made sure that, you know, it took a back.
And really, I wanted to say about, you know, leaving, generational leavings, I would say that we were given an absolute crap hole back in the 50s. And 60s. We, you know, the pollution, the air pollution, water pollution, it was horrible what we were doing, and the ripping of resources, and it was awful. And, you know, it took a lot of change to get us to where we are today. But the invisibility of CO2 is, you know, something that people, you know, when you could see what was spewing out of a smokestack and saying, you know, is that killing me? Well, yes, it is. But so we did something about it. It was highly visible. And you're right. It isn't visible to most people. Most people don't know what the impacts are. They don't know about the changes. And quite honestly, I felt horrified when I found out about the permafrost when I was doing my research. I was just like, whoa, this is nowhere near the prediction that they were giving us. This has me really scared. And then to see it on, you know, Netflix, and I'm like, whoa, it's there. They're showing it. Finally, people are becoming aware of what's happening. But they don't know how scary it is. They don't know how much is actually kept underneath permafrost.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's way more than we put out on an annual basis, way, way more.
Well, Sherwood said at lunch about automobiles. I mean, that blew me out of the water. About 49%.
Oh, yeah. Well, this is the break. Thanks, Steve, for bringing me back to my presentation.
Oh, sorry. I didn't know that's what that was.
So, globally, this is our national report card on greenhouse gases. So this is EPA's breakdown. So 28% comes from transportation. So that's the burning of fuels for transportation. 28% comes from electricity generation, meaning fossil fuel generation of electricity. We're not talking solar or wind or anything else. 28% of what we as a nation produce. 22% is produced from industry. And from our homes, burning natural gas, from commercial buildings, things like that, 11%. And agriculture basically produces about 9%. And that's typically the big equipment that agriculture uses. We're not talking about, you know, land development impacts right here. We're talking about, these are just the, you know. So that's kind of where we sit as a country right now. In the western United States, 49% of our emissions are transportation. 49%. So that's pretty huge. And do we really need to have Chilean fruit during the winter? What do you think? I will tell you that modes of transportation, ocean-going vessels, are the most less impactful than trucks and buses and trains and things like that. So they actually have converted to these really highly efficient diesel engines, and so their CO2 impacts are pretty darn small in comparison, like a per pound product weight. If I'm shipping a whole bunch of stuff up, I'd rather have them ship it via the ocean than fly it in or or train it up the coast or, yeah.
But so, if we look at this, the transportation and electricity, if we took care of that, we would take care of half of our emissions.
Absolutely.
So again, if we whether we make our own transportation choices,
mm-hmm.
or we look at legislation that does that, and right now we're seeing at a national level rollbacks of standards.
Right.
You know.
Right.
And electricity, we just have California that's committed to no fossil fuel electrical production by 2050, and they've got benchmarks to build up to that. And they're having a conference right now of bringing together all these governors and mayors to look at, the progress that individual areas can make, since we don't seem to currently have the national will to do this.
Yeah. The Western States Initiative also set targets for 2020 and 2030 and 2040 and 2050. And, what we're seeing in Washington State is the inability for us to do it.
The Western States kind of have an advantage too right now, just in that there's so much hydropower, and I think that that's one of the reasons why your transportation figure is so high.
It is.
For the 49%, it's because the electricity profile is going to be much, much lower in the West, just because of all the hydroelectric power.
That's right.
So percentages are a zero-sum game, so something goes down, something else has to go up. So per capita would be really interesting to see.
I don't have it.
I know.
Sorry.
That's a hard one, but I'm just saying that's the thing that also gets really tricky just about any of these big issues is that, you can present the data kind of any way you want to try to spin it the way you want. And so, like, percentages can be favorable or unfavorable depending on what your perspective is. Per capita can be unfavorable or unfavorable, and it's just...
I took a really quick look at the per capita by state...
Uh-huh.
So if you look at the state emissions and then you divide it by the population of that state, you can come up with a per capita per state. Well, I didn't do it, but it is, it's really very telling.
Mm-hmm.
And it's, we've got a lot of eastern states, and it's all along the eastern seaboard.
Mm-hmm.
They are the biggest emitters of CO2.
Mm-hmm.
And it's just... They're huge emitters, but they are also coal users, and fuel oil users, and then of course we see it along the state, the seaboard, the western seaboard,
which is getting hit by Florence, which sounds like it's going to be one of the more massive storms.
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
I hadn't heard that yet.
So where does it fit in that all at once in Washington State and for Puget Sound in particular, from my perspective, it's
mm-hmm.
where I live, we're losing our orcas.
Mm-hmm.
The big whales out in the Pacific are in real trouble, and it's because probably the heat is going up in the water. I don't know that. I don't know that for
mm-hmm.
sure. But I suspect that that isn't good for them.
Well, I know that we've lost a lot of our herring population in Puget Sound.
Mm-hmm.
So losing the herring population in Puget Sound reduces because they're a feeder fish for the salmon.
Right, and we aren't going to have salmon eventually.
So our salmon populations and our salmon runs, even though we keep on seeding some of those runs,
mm-hmm.
we're still not getting the runs. And with the water temperature change, that again changes the direction on where the salmons are going.
Yeah.
You know, and that affects the next largest population, which is the orcas. So yes, it's really troublesome.
Well,
really
Europe
troublesome.
This summer had massive fish kills.
Yeah.
Because the lakes got too hot.
Mm-hmm. Yes, that, you know, that all that red up there, it's been really tough. Really, really tough.
I have a question about transportation. I notice that there's been a reduction in transportation since the introduction of electric cars and hybrid cars. Has that reduced some at all, the percentage rate?
I'm sure it has. I haven't looked at the individual transportation, and it would mainly be, again, those are really more of a West Coast initiative than it is in the East. So I don't know how much we're seeing it impactful on the East Coast, but on the West Coast, yes. And so we are seeing that, you know, overall, per capita, you know, the West is being a little more responsive than the East.
What I've found is some people that I'm aware of, they're not very conscientious about how to heal the earth. They're doing it for tax incentives. So there was a big money piece to it, and which was great because then it will get people to pay attention or get something a little bit different.
Right.
But I do find that on some people I know, that's why they bought the electric cars.
Yeah, I know that, you know, for the people that I've heard from the most, they've gone to electric vehicles, they've put solar panels on their roofs, they'd like to go to a zero footprint. And that's really what they're trying to do, is really reduce their own personal carbon footprint, because it is an issue, and they'd rather start with themselves. And then they can go off and tell people, yes, this was successful, yes, this was what happened, and I was able to bring it down. I'm on a board with, I'm on the advisory council for the Northwest Clean Air Agency. And we're all very concerned about air quality and climate change. And one of my co-board members, she and I were talking, and she was just like, we were building our houses at about the same time. And she said, well, what are you doing with regards to your heat source? I said, well, we're putting in this big, huge masonry heater that's going to be wood burner. And it's highly efficient, and, you know, I explained how it worked and everything. She goes, that's really cool. She said, we're going to put in solar. We're just going to go solar panel. That's the way we're doing it. So we're talking some more, and she said, are you guys putting in, you know, an electric for charging a vehicle? I said, well, as a matter of fact, that's what my husband wanted to do, was to make sure that we had our own charging station in our garage. So people, as they're thinking about development and they're thinking about change, everybody's trying to reduce their footprint. Those are the people that I work with, so I know how they're thinking. But I'm not out in the world enough to know why people say the things that they do about global warming and climate change.
Do we know if, like in a perfect world right now, in a magical world, if we were to switch from all gasoline engines for our cars to all electric cars, do we know if the environmental impact would be lessened, or are we just shifting it because we're using more electricity and we need fuel or some kind of fuel to create that electricity? I mean, is there a net gain to switching, or is it just that we are not directly, you know, dependent on fossil fuels?
So I think that there's a net gain, but it depends, again, on where you live. Like for me, if I was in the East Coast and I was going to go get an electric car, I would think, where's my source of electricity? Are they using coal? If they're using coal, I'm not doing the world any good by increasing the coal consumption and, you know, the excessive
electricity.
Right. Yeah. That is not a good source. So that's not a net benefit. That's bad. So you're better off burning gasoline than, you know, than having that coal. But it's, you know, it's a balance. What's going to be more efficient? What's going to be the best way to do it? And it depends on where you live. You know, we're really lucky. Sometimes in Washington State, one of the things that we kind of put our foot down in the last several years was not purchasing power from Colstrip in Montana.
Yeah.
Because what do you think Colstrip in Montana uses as a fuel source?
Mm-hmm.
So we had to tell Puget Sound Energy, stop buying electrical power from Colstrip, because we don't want to support Colstrip. And Puget Sound listened. Puget Sound Energy listened. And so they've made their changes, and it really makes a big impact. And I will tell you that I do corporate greenhouse gas reporting for companies, and we do have to report our indirect greenhouse gas emissions. And so if you're buying electricity from a company, you have to know how much of that energy is producing greenhouse gases and how much is hydro or wind or solar. And trying to get these corporations, these energy corporations, to go to a lower impact, you know, energy source isn't that hard. It really isn't that hard. Talk to your utilities. Really talk to them. Say, hey, I heard about this. I'm really concerned. Can you tell me how we're getting it? And when are we going to be greenhouse gas emission free? What's your projection on that? When are we going to go and be off of fossil fuels? It's really important. It's important to ask those questions, because I will tell you that the people who made the biggest impact on Puget Sound Energy were their largest consumers. And who were their largest consumers? The refineries and Alcoa. And they wanted to make sure that on the global report card, how they looked was that their impact per pound of production was lower than their competitors. And that energy intensity index is something that people compare, and they say, oh, look at, they've got a much lower energy intensity index. That's fantastic. We think they're doing things right. They're using less energy, and they're making sure that it doesn't produce greenhouse gases. That's pretty important. Pretty important thing for all of us to be aware of and trying. And I understand why I know, because I do that reporting. But I think everybody needs to know so they can compare those companies and make those choices. Any other questions about that? Thank you all for your input.
Well, they're good if you do your homework.
Mm-hmm.
I was impacted by a Christian radical by the name of Shane Claiborne out of Philadelphia, I think, who is really leading a movement in the church for these kinds of things. And he even gives us an example of how he reduces the use of any automobile to compensate for flying,
mm-hmm.
and to exchange something credits, whatever
yeah.
it is. You know, and I got, so some of the airlines are now giving you the information
mm-hmm.
of what's the footprint for flying to Europe and how you can compensate for that.
Yeah.
And I think that's a very interesting way to go about, again, taking personal responsibility. Now, he's got a whole bunch of other ideas. It really does drastically simplify lifestyle,
mm-hmm.
that it wouldn't hurt Christian churches to sit and talk about.
Yeah, to be proponents
mm-hmm.
for.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and I'm going to wait until Thursday, but I've got some really great information about the different advocacy groups within the church. Because we are doing great things. We are making great strides. We just have to get it out to the church. To the church, the individual churches, so that they know. So, okay. Next is just, oops, I didn't want to ask this question. I'm going to back up. Sorry. I'm going to ask you. What do you think stewardship means? So I would really like you to grab a marker, go on up there and tell me what you think stewardship means. Or if you don't want to do that, Mike will volunteer to go up and write down all your questions. But if you want to get up, because you've been sitting for an hour, you want to stand up, you can. Okay. So what does stewardship mean to you?
Management.
What did you say? I don't know what you hear.
I think it starts with mindfulness and you know, doing what we're doing now. Know what we're doing and what maybe what we should be doing.
Can you read this?
No.
Not too big, too small.
Too small. It's too small for us. So what's been written so far?
Management and mindfulness.
Okay.
All right, Marjorie.
Thank you.
Changing behaviors.
Is that better?
Yeah.
Living out the sacredness of creation on a daily basis.
Write it out.
Okay.
Living out the sacredness of creation on a daily basis. Don't just do it Sunday at 10 o'clock. Don't just do it when we come up to the altar. It's what we do. It's who we are. It's how we're known in our communities. It's how we're known in our families, our friendship circles. And it's diverse, too. How I do it is not how anybody else in this room does it. Because God calls different gifts into each of us. And I don't expect everyone to do it the way I do it. That would be... It's diverse, too.
Do you need another one?
Yeah. You got the diverse on it, too, sorry. Next one. It's modified.
Bring up some of these things.
Ways.
Yeah, diverse, D-I-V-E-R. Yeah, got that right, diverse ways. Uh-huh. Cool, thanks.
Or do you say?
What?
Oh, okay. Just bring up some of these issues to our council, church councils, and president, too, and the pastor.
So see it reflected in our church leadership? Is that another way of saying it?
And that's a better way to say it, yes.
Or advocacy, is that kind of what you're shooting for too, a little bit, or no?
Yes.
Is it us as individuals, or is it hearing them reflect it back to the congregation at large?
Just the awareness part of it, of, you know, what are we doing in our congregations? We know a few, I know a few minor things, but, you know, what are we doing?
To me, stewardship is like the gardener that goes out in the garden and pulls the weeds and rakes and pulls the bugs off the plants and just takes care of. He's the tender.
The caretaker.
Caretaker.
And Peter said advocacy. Is that a part of your definition of stewardship?
Sure, it can be. I was just trying to... She was fishing for some an idea, and I was just throwing an idea out there, but I think it works.
Okay.
Any
advocate, is that okay?
I think the point is that it's not just an individual thing, it's a big thing, it's a community thing, and so advocacy is for trying to get everyone involved.
I think it's also tied to our local places. Like, for example, in Washington, 25% of our pollinators are at risk of extinction. I mean, how many of us know that? You know, we see little things buzzing around.
Right.
But we could be planting things in our gardens. Mm-hmm. We could have our public gardens that help pollinators. So I'm taking up on your caretaker idea.
Yes. But,
so it has to be tied locally, too. You can't just only talk about the Arctic and how many of us ever get to the Arctic. What do you know about your own local geography and how it is impacted?
So are mason bees still a thing? So
people
drill lots of holes in boards for mason bees?
Yes, absolutely. You've got bee blocks.
Mason, it's a different kind of bee that's a pollinator, and you can make homes for it just by drilling holes in boards, and then they come and colonize.
Because they don't colonize. They're solitary.
Right.
Oh.
So they don't have a hive. They just, cracks and crevices
in
the holes,
but they're
individually.
Yeah. So you make drilling holes into a block of wood and put it up somewhere nice and warm, and they'll find it and make a
home. Or you can be a person that promotes mason bee growth in your community. We have that on my island. We have a guy, and you can go get your little starters and go. You do that. Your congregation could be the mason bee disseminator. I mean, that promotes hope, right? Wouldn't you love to have your school kids and the kids in your congregation taking home their little containers of mason bees and looking at where they drill holes? I mean,
connects Western them. As well as Western?
I don't know.
Yeah,
I think they're all over the country.
They pollinate 80 to 100 times more plants than honeybees do. I mean, they're a much harder workers. I don't want to knock the honeybees, but I just find it interesting. I learned that a few years ago, and it's amazing.
Yep.
And there's, quite a few different species. They don't always look like bees. Sometimes they look like little flies, and they're very small.
It also would be better for your health if you do more walking rather than driving just a short ways to the grocery store when you really could walk probably.
Mm-hmm. Right, it's kind of like if it's less than 2 miles when you walk it.
Yeah.
I'm going to show you mine. So, I was in a woman's retreat and thinking about how God calls me. And I wrote this definition of what stewardship means to me. And I just think it's using God's gifts to us wisely, sustaining God's creation by using only what can be renewed, conserving precious resources, enjoying activities that leave no trace, caring and protecting voiceless creatures, plants, and ecosystems, and then minimize the scarring of people and planets.
How many planets are we using?
Well,
I thought we just lived on one.
It's this one, but it's also, we send things out. And I don't know what it's doing. It kind of worries me. What if, this thing crash landed in Jupiter on one of Jupiter's moons? Is that going to do something really bad? I don't know. It's not something I would have thought of to do. But distributes God's abundance with social justice. And so that was my definition of stewardship. It's a lot. But we are the hands and feet of God in this world, and the mouth, and the ears. So, we really do need to listen, and we do need to be willing to act. And that's really what I have been trying to tell people this week and in other aspects of my life, is we need to act. We need to move on. And, you know, I don't drive if it's 2 miles or less thing. That's just a me-ism. You choose what's best for you, obviously, and your capabilities. So I have friends that don't drive a car. They only take their bikes.
Mm-hmm.
So that's wonderful. I love it. I am 8 miles from town, and I've got no good safe bike routes, all uphill. Yeah, so it's probably not going to be me. But I am also one who really makes sure that those trips to town consolidate. So I really thought a lot about it, really did a lot of prayerful consideration when I put together what it means to me. And I hope you will as well. What does stewardship really mean to you? We're about done. And the last thing I had was a carbon footprint calculator. EPA has this wonderful website that'll let you figure out what your carbon footprint is. And I really suggest that you go online, go to EPA's website, just look for EPA carbon footprint calculator, and take it for a spin. You just put in, you know, what your household kind of does and calculate your impact. I was going to bring one up. I decided against that. I'm going to show you, though, what King County does. So we have a wonderful process in the State Environmental Protection Act to determine what our impacts are for new developments and new projects. And so this is a little calculator, kind of, it makes a whole bunch of assumptions that are in some of the supplying spreadsheets, and it says how many, you know, if you're a single family home and how large is your impact going to be, how many square foot are you adding to your house, hundreds, thousands, then you go ahead and you plug in a number, let's do this, let's say it's a 3,500, oops, square foot home.
That's pretty big right there. That's the way the Americans do it. We live in a way too big
home. That's a big one.
Mm-hmm. Our parents did it a lot less.
They did. That's absolutely true. So
I think you need to change the number of units to 1 on column C.
Oh, yeah. Thank you. Let's see if my calculator works. Yep.
Okay.
So that's kind of what they come up with calculation-wise.
What does that mean, lifespan? Does that mean the span of the house or the person? What's lifespan?
So lifespan on a house, they go through and they define. Let's see what they say. I would guess that it's the length of a mortgage.
Yeah, that's what I would guess.
You could click on the cell and see if it pops up in the form.
Yeah, I will.
But our carbon footprints, aren't they usually calculated in annual basis?
They usually are.
Yeah.
Yes.
I mean, 30 years, my life's going to change a lot. You know, over a 30-year span,
in our SEPA stuff, what we've done is we've, I think we've pretty much gone to a 30-year. So it's saying the average building lifespan is 57.9 for a residential building. So that's 57, almost 58 years of lifespan.
Well, how about some of those other categories, like healthcare, outpatient? How does that work?
Oh, so what they do is how many units of are you building? So
buildings?
Yeah, these are all new projects.
So for hospitals,
right.
Mm-hmm. Clinics, yep. And that sort
yep.
of thing.
So these are all new projects, and King County just went.
Well, I talked to somebody today, and at their church, they try to, instead of having a garbage service, do their,
mm-hmm.
I I guess like their community time and what kind of food they bring in, garbage service, and just try to reuse, redo, recycle, that type of thing. And
yep. So I was the civil and environmental manager for a multidisciplinary engineering firm. And we started, you know, kind of looking at our impacts in the world. And I told them we did this coffee thing for our company just because we wanted people to stop making trips to Starbucks and Grusin Coffee and all the other coffee places. If we came up with a fair trade coffee and we, you know, basically made it easier for everybody, we were going to save those emissions, plus people were going to save a lot of money, not going to Starbucks all the time. So we came up with this, you know, really good idea. And it saved about $100,000 a year. When I went and talked to other offices in our corporation, you know, we had set up recycling programs, we had set up all this stuff for a corporation. And I went to Billings, Montana, and I was doing an audit for a client and looked at our office and I went, you guys don't have any recycling. What is wrong with you? We're supposed to be recycling. He goes, the office manager said, you've made just so much work for me because there is no recycling in Montana. I said, oh, baloney, there's recycling in Montana. He goes, no, we've got enough ditches in Montana that still need to be filled. So people aren't recycling in Montana. And I said, that is a horrible excuse. And I immediately went out and found recycling facilities for the office. But I was just like, what a lazy so-and-so. You know? Here's a corporate, you know, mandate that we have recycling in our offices and we're doing all these different things to reduce our carbon footprint, and he's gonna just go throw things in the garbage. So yes, you battle it everywhere. You gotta overcome our inertia and get moving. But I really recommend that you look at the EPA one to figure it out. Just what are they looking at? As to what your impact is versus other people's impact. And like you pointed out, Peter, I probably should run those numbers to see per capita, per state, how we're doing, what the range is. Because I think it's a pretty big range.
How's Bellingham doing?
Bellingham's doing really well. I think they've made their commitment for green energy. I think they're 100% green energy.
That's my city too.
Yeah, I think they've done it. Mm-hmm. I had a hydro project that I, so we have a greenhouse gas grant program through Northwest Clean Air Agency. So we've used greenhouse gas mitigation money, and we've had things like opportunity housing. Whoops, this is next. Can't see that. We've had Opportunity Council come in, and they applied for a grant. So they've done all the low-income housing upgrades to high-efficiency furnaces and to, you know, get rid of all the old oil burners. We're doing a lot of wood stove replacement stuff. Mm-hmm. So all that to decrease emissions and greenhouse gases. Mm-hmm. City of Bellingham was... applied for one of the grants, and they were going to put in a hydro plant using the old GP water right. And I think I don't know where that is. They haven't finalized proposal to us. We're hoping that they'll go ahead and do something else that's going to be impactful to reduce greenhouse gas emissions. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you.